Short disclaimer. This podcast is in no way affiliated with the Stars production or Diana Gabaldon. All views expressed are solely our own. Welcome to the Outlander podcast,
where the men are kilted,
the women are winsome,
and the whiskey is neat.
Welcome to episode 79 of the Outlander podcast. I'm Ginger.
And I'm Summer, and we are in love with all things Outlander.
So announcements this week. We got a new picture from Outlander Star's Instagram account, which is a picture of Frank and Claire in their wedding garb, which is actually a rather striking photo, where you can obviously see the cameraman and a bunch of the other stuff going on behind the scenes, but they're just very striking, those two. We also got a video from Outlander Stars regarding the special features available on the Blu-ray that's going to be released shortly. We also got a deleted scene from the Wedding Night episode where there appears to be some new pillow talk that was not included in the original version of the episode.
It was deleted, but not the entire scene. Part of a scene. Or actually, the majority of this scene. On their wedding night, when they talk about each other's families, most of that discussion was deleted. The discussion does happen, but as Ron says, they decided to make it more of a montage than show the entire scene. So they made it into a montage, and a good bit was deleted.
But the beauty of a montage is that montages only work best when you've actually filmed all of it.
Oh, you have to.
And then you give kind of like little snippets. Mm-hmm. That's how montages work best. So he did the right thing. It was announced that a rough table of contents for The Outlandish Companion Volume 2 has been released.
And you can find this on Diana's Facebook
Absolutely.
Page.
And that is this week's announcements. Before we go into our read-along this week, we do have a little special interview that we have with a gentleman by the name of Ken Deep, who is the showrunner for the Long Island Geek Convention. He also is the showrunner for the Long Island Doctor Who Convention. But apparently, this is the first year of the Long Island Geek Convention, and it's a doozy. Like, I think for Outlander fans especially, this is going to be something we're all a little interested in.
We can't wait to hear how things go down. So, Ken Deep, welcome to the Outlander podcast. How are you?
I'm fantastic. Thanks, Ginger and Summer, for having me on. It's great to be here.
Tell us a little bit about yourself and what you have to do with this Long Island Geek Convention and podcasting.
Well, I'm the showrunner of LI Geek, which is a general sci-fi and fantasy convention, and it's the twin brother, sister, depending on what gender you want to pick. Let's say twin sister, since we have two ladies on the podcast. It's the twin sister of LI Who, which is our annual Doctor Who convention. And I'm the showrunner of both. And after doing a few successful Doctor Who conventions, there was a need for our brand of sci-fi convention here on Long Island. And I'm not just a Doctor Who fan. I'm a fan of all kinds of sci-fi and fantasy, Star Wars, Star Trek, Lord of the Rings, everything. And so it was like, well, I'm doing Doctor Who over here. Now I need a reason to do other geeky goodness over here. And so I decided, along with some friends, to make the show LI Geek. And it's a sci-fi and fantasy con May 2nd and 3rd, 2015, here on Long Island.
And how did you come to find out about Outlander?
Well, it's funny. I have a whole bunch of friends that are Outlander fans, mostly ladies, I might add, including my mom, who were big fans of the books. And I'm a huge Doctor Who fan, huge, for 30 years. And my podcasting background, I'm one of the first, I'm like the pioneer of Doctor Who, a pioneer of Doctor Who podcasting. Myself and my two co-hosts, James and Lewis Trapani, on a show called Doctor Who Podshock, were one of the first ever Doctor Who podcasts. I think we are the first, but this, anyway, it's a long story about that. But that's like some 10 years ago that we got started in podcasting. I'm very podcaster friendly in all of my conventions because I'm a podcaster. So going back to Outlander, being a podcaster in Doctor Who, I was interviewing Fraser Hines, one day for Doctor Who, as you know, famously played Jamie in Doctor Who in the 60s. And he was the first person to ever mention, you know, there's actually a character in a book that I was named after. And he didn't say it that way. He said it with a Scottish/British accent. And I was like, wow, that's amazing. Like, how cool is it to have influenced someone else? You know, I thought that was great. And he was rightfully very proud of it. And then along comes Ron Moore, who I adore from Star Trek and Battlestar and all his geek credentials, and Stars, who are brilliant because, you know, non-commercial cable's the way to go. I'm a Game of Thrones fan and was a Sopranos fan and Sex and the City. And you name every great show, and 9 out of 10 of them in the last, like, decade are all on commercial-free cable. So the fact that it was coming to air, you know, that Outlander was being converted from a book to a television series and in the right hands, with a very talented creative team, and then eventually a very talented cast. This was something pretty exciting, and being so many of my friends are Outlander fans, I knew when I started a convention that I wanted to have someone that was in Outlander as one of my headlining guests. And through a connection in Doctor Who, Sylvester McCoy, who is the 7th Doctor in Doctor Who, and Graham are both in The Hobbit, Graham McTavish. And one evening a couple of years ago, we went out for drinks in L.A., and I met Graham for the first time. This was pre-Outlander. It was fresh off the Hobbit trilogy. And he's, like, the greatest guy. He's so fun, and he's really easygoing. And I said, if I ever had a convention that would fit what Graham does, he would be the first guy invited. And that's no joke. When we made L.I. Geek, the first guest I invited was Graham McTavish. And it was just great that he's also now in Outlander, and he was in Red Dwarf, and he was in the Hobbit trilogy, and he's just cool. I mean, it's as cool as they get. I was no way prepared for the reaction that we got to announcing Graham. I mean, people absolutely lost their mind that he's coming to Long Island. And so I just wanted to get the word out there, and I'm being a podcaster, I said to Andre, my press liaison, contact some Outlander podcasts. Let's tell the world that we have this amazing guest coming to our show.
And we think that makes sense. The audience that you can reach through us is 100% contact audience that you want.
Well, I mean, being a longtime podcaster, I have enormous respect for podcasting. And I think it's something that traditional advertisers just haven't wrapped their heads around yet, right? Mm-hmm. The audience for the Outlander podcast is 100% the target audience for everything Outlander. So every person who's listening right now, they're not tuning in for, like, the sports or weather. They're tuning in to hear you two talk about Outlander. And so it just, to me, it so much makes sense. It's why I embrace them.
So as an Outlander, if I were an Outlander fan coming to the Long Island convention, how are you planning to feature Mr. McTavish?
Well, he's going to speak each day at least once, maybe more than once. So he'll be on stage doing like a Q&A and a panel. And I usually have a moderator. I like to have someone on stage with him so that it kind of keeps things going. And, you know, sometimes occasionally at a sci-fi convention, I know this is unusual, but occasionally you get someone who asks a really weird question. So a moderator will help you get over that hurdle. We do a lot of meet and greets. I'm really big on fan-friendly stuff. With no disrespect to Comic-Cons, San Diego, New York Comic-Con, stuff like that, those big, giant conventions. That's not what this is about. My conventions, the ones that I show run, are typically 1,000 to 2,000 people, which sounds like it's a lot, but compare that to 150,000 at San Diego or New York or something. And so your odds of spending a little quality time with someone that you admire is a lot better than it is, you know, versus 100,000 people. I like to have everyone have that moment with their hero. You know what I mean? Like, you go up, maybe get an autograph or take a photo with someone, or just interact in some basic way. To me, that's what the experience is about, right? Like that to be able to go back to work, back to your daily grind or whatever, and you say, hey, you'll never believe who I met on the weekend. I met Graham McTavish, you know, the guy from Outlander. We took a photo together, and I asked him about that thing that he did in that episode. Like, that kind of moment. I'm a fan. I totally get that, right? To get my questions answered is so huge about maybe the character, about the show, about what it's like to be there in person, to find out maybe a deleted scene or something they tried. I mean, that's why we go. And for L.I. Geek, the general admission gets you in the door. You can see Graham speak or answer questions. And you know, as with conventions now, there's an autograph signing, photo op. It's an additional charge, but you can go take a photo or you can go get an autograph. But I have a VIP ticket. I have a Graham McTavish up close ticket for like diehard Outlander fans or diehard Hobbit fans or diehard anything Graham's been in fans, just people who are an admirer of his. And that includes an autograph, includes a photo with him, priority access to all his talks over the weekend. And then I have probably the coolest thing about it is there'll be a meet and greet with Graham where it's limited to just the amount of these VIP tickets that we sell, which is capped out. I won't sell more than 100 of them. It's just that simple. It probably won't go that high. You know, I mean, I could, because Graham's got a ton of fans and we've sold a boatload of them already. But his meet and greet won't have more than 100 people where you can walk around, shake his hand, give him a big hug, whatever he's up for. Ask a question. Just that sort of that human interaction like we're having now. I mean, minus the fact that we're on Skype, you know. But if you were like, you know what, I really want to ask him or I really want to tell him, or you know, people knit now. That's like a huge thing. Like, oh, I'm going to give him a scarf or I'm going to give him a hat or something. It's so cool. So that's some of the things that we have going on at L.I. Geek.
That actually sounds like an amazing opportunity. And if we lived even like 1,000 miles closer, like if we were in mid-America or Midwest, we would absolutely do our best to show up. But is this the first?
This is our first year, yeah.
So hopefully not the last.
And
hopefully a continued Outlander presence. We all hope and pray that Outlander, we're going into season 2 now. They're going into production in April or May.
Yep.
So, well, technically in production, they're going into filming in April or May. So we know that there's a season 2. We pray for all the books and all the seasons, but we would love to maybe try and get out there in another year.
Well, you both of you have an open invitation to join us, of course. And I'm going to give you a scoop right now on our on our Doctor Who convention, which is in November. It's every November here on Long Island. This is not on our website. It's not even on the Doctor Who podcast yet, but I'm so excited to tell you this. Well, you know, Fraser Hines, who Jamie Fraser is heavily influenced by, Fraser comes to L.I. Who every year. And I hear, I hope this isn't a spoiler, but I hear he's making an appearance in an upcoming episode, because he was really geeked up that, like, he got a chance to have a small part and, you know, as a sort of thank you for inspiring Jamie Fraser's character in the books and now the series. So he's not even on our website yet, but he's definitely coming, because Fraser's like the godfather of Long Island Who, right? He has to come and give his blessing every year. And I just saw him in L.A. last weekend at a big Doctor Who show there, and he's definitely coming back. So by the time we have him in November, he'll have already hopefully made an appearance in the show, because I think it's this second half of the first season that he's going to be in.
Yeah, which he plays.
Yeah, I'm not even sure. Like,
I can't think of the name.
Who he was going to be scheduled to play? Wentworth Prison. It's scheduled to air May 16th. Let me look and see if he's on the cast list. I'm going to inaccurate movie database right now. and seeing if it's on there. Of course, when I want to click on it, it's nowhere to be found. So, you know what? Why don't I just type in Fraser Hines and see what comes up? I'm sure it will mislead me somewhere. Let's see. Down a rabbit hole here. Outlander. He's playing Sir Fletcher Gordon.
Yeah, the governor of Wentworth.
Yeah,
he's in charge of Wentworth Prison, and he's the one that... I don't think I'm giving away... Well, I'm not going to say what happens, but there's a prison involved.
Okay.
He's the governor of that prison, and there's someone at the prison that's
one character goes to try and get released. That's why he's a character.
Is he a bad guy then?
No, he's not really a bad guy. He's just
English, and if being English alone is what makes you a bad guy, then yeah, he's a bad guy. But no,
he's part of the occupying English, so that puts him on one side. But as a character, he's more of a functionary than anything. He doesn't play a good or bad role.
Right.
He's just
there
serving the purpose. Exactly.
Yeah. So cool. So that's coming up in May. It actually may be right after our convention, like a week or two after. If this schedule is anything close to accurate, it'll be sometime in May. So Fraser's coming to L.I. Who in November. So I'm constantly – okay, so one other scoop for you. Also coming and not yet announced on our Long Island Doctor Who website is Annette Badland.
Oh.
Uh-oh. Mrs. Fitz.
Who is famous in Doctor Who.
In
its first season, playing a real baddie, actually. But she's also has Outlander cred. So we actually will have two Outlander characters at our Doctor Who show on top of that. So I'm hoping that this is something that's going to be ongoing. I would love it. Listen, in my dreams at LI Geek 2016, the two of you will be podcasting live with more Outlander guests on stage doing our thing. But really, quite honestly, we got to get the first one off the ground. And that's why I'm here. And I have, in my mind, I have an amazing start in having Graham McTavish.
Absolutely. And we would be honored.
But you know, Graham's not the only one coming in May. I think most people, we don't follow just one thing, and especially if you like this kind of programming, this kind of television show, you're probably into some other, like, let's call it alternative television, like not reality show junk. I have David Warner coming, who is a legendary actor from time after time, Time Bandits, Doctor Who, James Cameron's Titanic, Tron, Star Trek V, Star Trek VI, Star Trek The Next Generation from Ron Moore. I have Finn Jones from Game of Thrones coming. I have an actor named Spencer Wilding, who's a 7-foot-tall dude that's played all kinds of creatures and stuff. I have Nina Toussaint-White from Doctor Who. So I have, you know, a nice guest list, including Graham. And the same thing goes, of course, with Doctor Who. I have a ton of Doctor Who people coming for a Doctor Who convention. So I think it's the kind of thing that you'll find things. If you were coming for Graham, you'll find other things that you'll be interested in. Because you might be like, oh, damn, I love Game of Thrones, right? Yeah, I got a Game of Thrones person coming. So now there's like double the reason to come and enjoy geeky goodness, sci-fi and fantasy and stuff. Just come and enjoy yourself. Hear people speak. You know, shop around. We have a huge vendor hall. Just spend a little quality time on Long Island if you're not from Long Island. That time of year, it's going to be beautiful here.
Well, it sounds amazing, and we would urge any and all Outlander fans who have an interest and – I'm sorry. Any and all Outlander fans are definitely interested in Graham McTavish. That's not a question. But anyone who has even an inkling of a thought, even if you don't have a thought, go check out the information about the Long Island Geek Convention. And Kendeep, could you share with us your contact information? What's the best place for someone to go to find out about either one of your cons?
Well, Long Island Geek, or LI Geek as we call it, it's longislandgeek.com is the website. You'll also find us on Facebook and Twitter. And then the Doctor Who Convention in November, it's Long Island Doctor Who. Fully spelled out. We don't abbreviate Doctor. It's a religious thing amongst Doctor Who fans. So Long Island Doctor Who is fully spelled out. And that as well, we're on Facebook and Twitter and Tumblr and every other social media outlet to keep up on things that are going on at both events, actually. And it's just a good way of staying in the loop. I have a really nice hotel planned for LI Geek. Because this actually takes place at a sports arena. It's an indoor soccer stadium where LI Geek takes place. But there's a hotel a couple miles from there that's the official convention hotel. We have a special rate hooked up for that for people coming from out of town or just people who want to be close to the event here on Long Island. And on top of that, I have an official travel agent, a group called Linmar Travel here on Long Island, who help people come Like if you were saying, like the two of you, you say, okay, I'm coming from California. I want to fly to Long Island. I want to have my, I'm going to come in 2 days early. I want to take a tour of Manhattan, or I want to go out to see the lighthouse or whatever. I have a travel agent that will help you, will walk you through the entire process of coming to LI Geek or LI Who.
Wow. Well, it sounds like you have the perfect setup. You have so much to offer for someone, not just here you can buy your tickets. You know what I mean? You have so much. You guys have put a lot of thought and planning into not just the events, but also the experience of not just the conventions, but the whole experience of getting to Long Island and staying there.
Well, we have a lot of cooperation from the Long Island Convention and Visitors Bureau here on Long Island. You know, they promote tourism to Long Island, and it's why LI is in all of our, you know, is on our name. I mean, I'm a lifelong Long Islander. I'm proud of the area that I come from, and I want to bring people here to see it and have a good time on top of just, you know, putting on a fun show. It's a fan-run convention. It's by fans, for fans. I've been going to conventions for 30 years. I know what it takes to make them fun and enjoyable. I want each person to walk away from the event saying, I had a great time, or I got what I wanted out of it, whether that be meeting someone or getting a question answered or dressing up in costumes or, you know, whatever. Whatever it is that you bring, whatever goodwill you bring to a convention to make that experience great, I want you to leave there saying, I feel satisfied now.
Excellent. Well, we definitely look forward to the opportunity to one day be able to attend.
That would be fantastic.
We would very much enjoy that, I know. And so we want to thank you so much for spending a few minutes of your weekend with us.
Well, I want to thank you both for taking time out to you know, hear me rant.
It's not a rant when it has to do with, if you mentioned Graham McTavish, you've got us.
We had you with Graham, is that it?
Yeah, pretty much.
That's so cool.
Actually, it's not Graham, it's Outlander, but of course, Graham is part of Outlander.
Cool. Well, ladies, thank you very much for giving me a little bit of your time on the podcast today.
No, absolutely.
No worries. And if you want to come back before the Doctor Who one, because as you said, of the genre connections with other shows of people playing who maybe are in Outlander, but even though your convention is for Doctor Who, just reach out and we're happy to have you back to do a little information session before that one as well.
Fantastic. That would be great.
Okay. Well, thank you so much.
Thanks, Summer. Thanks, Ginger.
Thank you.
Thank you. Have a great weekend. Bye bye.
And now on to our read-along. This week we will be reading chapter 18 entitled Rape in Paris.
But before we get to the rape...
Is that a good segue?
I don't think so. Oh, that was not a very good segue.
Right, cool.
Before we get to the chapter, we have a special guest. Summer, who's our guest? Or should we just ask her and see?
I'm sorry, we're a little giggly today.
That's okay, I am too. I've been breathing paint fumes all morning, so I'm...
Oh, no. Okay. Well, since you just heard her voice, you may have guessed. Guess, could you tell us who you are?
It's Teresa from Outlander Kitchen. Hi, everybody. It's great to be here.
Yay! So, Teresa from Outlander Kitchen, can you tell us a bit about what's been going on in your never-busy life since you've been with us last?
Well, it's been a while, so I've been up to quite a few things. Number one, I did a little bit of Outlander travel in the last, let's say, 6 to 8 months. So I went down to Seattle for the launch of Moby in the summer. And then I've also been, where else have I been? I've been down to see another Outlander friend for a weekend, which was a lot of fun. I love getting together with my online Outlander friends because we always have a gas and we understand each other for some strange reason. And then I guess the biggest news is lots of people are interested in an Outlander Kitchen cookbook, and I'm not quite ready to make the big announcement yet, but we've certainly made some progress. It's quite a complicated endeavor because there's a TV series involved now, and I need Diana's permission and all sorts of things. So Diana has been kind enough to sign an agreement that allows me to pursue a cookbook, and we're just figuring out a few more details before we start that pursuit. So that's really exciting. And then in other news, Diana has asked me to contribute a little bit about 18th century cookery to the Outlandish Companion 2. So I'm really excited about that, and that's my biggest deadline that's coming up really quickly because it's going to print very soon and it's going to be out in the fall this year.
Now, on something like that where you are contributing to someone else's work, and you already said the turnaround is pretty tight, is pretty quick. What kind of turnaround did you have between being given guidelines or just a formal request and then you having to produce?
Well, I was asked if I wanted to be a part of it, let's see, 2 or 3 weeks ago now by Diana. And now we're just actually still working out some details, but I'm working on the piece now in my head as well as on my screen. And the rough deadline that we're looking at right now is the end of March. So it'll be, let's say, a 6 to 7 week turnaround. And it's not going to be a terribly long piece. I don't really know how long it'll be. And Diana didn't give me a lot of guidelines. She sort of just said, do whatever you want to do and check with me. And if that's okay, then we'll go ahead.
Well, very cool. So
now if you haven't, and not you, Teresa, but you, the listener, have not actually tried any of Teresa's recipes, I can personally vouch for a few of them. I can't cook all of them because I'm, you know, carb-free. It's kind of boring. But I did make your shepherd's pie, which was amazing. I've never actually gone so far as to cook with wine before, and I was like, I'm doing it. Because usually I like to drink my wine, but I decided I would sacrifice some for the greater good.
Sometimes you have to sacrifice a glass to the dish. It's hard to do.
It sounded like you said, sacrifice a glass to the dish.
The dish.
No, and like I think I use so many different like cooking implements in my kitchen that I don't normally pull out, so that was exciting as well. But it made this like giant shepherd's pie, and I used cauliflower instead of potatoes for the topping.
That's right, I remember.
Oh, it was so good. It was so good. I ate on that for like a week.
And I made Blackjack Randall's lavender fudge. It was very good, and I need to make another recipe.
I am making actually some onion gravy from the Bangers and Mash.
Onion gravy and mushroom gravy are my two favorites.
Do you make your own bangers or do you buy them?
We make our own sausages, but they're generally, it's a cured, like a chorizo or an andouille. So for a bangers and mash, we will buy them.
Because I could do a bangers and mash now that I know that cauliflower tastes pretty amazing, like mashed potatoes. So.
Oh, yeah, no, cauliflower mash is really, really good, and it's a great... It's very hot right now with all the paleo and all the low-carb people, but it's really, actually really one of the tastier things that's a substitute, I think.
Which I think is amazing because I hate cauliflower in any other way.
Oh, no,
but
you're
for
kidding.
Whatever reason, I don't like it raw and I don't like it steamed, but if I roast it, I think it's amazing. If I use it, I've made pizza crusts with it.
Oh, my gosh.
And they're really good.
So good.
And then as mashed potatoes, they're amazing. But other than that, like if it's raw or just steamed, I don't want anything to do with it.
Okay, now, just so you know, I think, listeners, you'll be able to know by the time we get to maybe the end or middle of the chapter why Teresa selected this chapter.
Yeah, it wasn't the rapiness at the beginning.
Yeah, because if you went by title alone, I was very confused. I was like, really?
I was like, I'll take 18, rape in Paris.
Sorry. That's not funny, but... None of us focus on the rapiness. No.
No, but you know, it was funny because Ginger
Mary.
And I were talking. Ginger and I were talking last week when we were recording for last week, and she was like, "Oh yeah, Teresa wants to join us for chapter 18," and I was like, "A rape in Paris?" I was like, "Really?" And then I read the chapter, and I was like, oh, "Okay, I get it."
But there has to be a meal involved, but.
It was just the chapter title alone threw me for a
moment. Oh my goodness. Yeah, that's a title and a half right there. Okay, so the chapter opens. It is the beginning of May, and just reading that, I thought
Jamie's birthday.
That's or near to it. Well, or it's either on or after. Jamie has just had a birthday or is on his birthday. And how far along does this make Claire? Jamie was rescued just on or after Christmas. And so that would have been end of December. So here we are just past the end of April, which is basically 4 months. And she knew she was pregnant before or as they rescued him.
Yes.
Or thereabouts.
Yes.
So she couldn't have been more than what, a month to 6 weeks?
I would, yeah. You're talking to the wrong girl. But I would
Oh, you're
say,
talking to the wrong person here too. But
okay, but,
but
you know,
I
the
would
whole
say, yeah, I would say she was at 4 to 6 weeks when she told him at the end of Outlander. is always what I would
imagine. So it's a totally different animal from today, because today you can take a pregnancy test the day of your missed period and know that you're pregnant.
Exactly.
But then you in that time period, you would have to wait until it didn't show up. It didn't show up, and then you just start counting and try to figure it out. But
so if it is four weeks, then that's a month, then that would be about 5 months. If she knew at the end of December that it was 4 weeks, then that's four more months, then that's 5 months. If it was 6 weeks, then that would have been, I guess, 5.5 months. So between 4.5 and 5 months or something like that?
Yeah, I mean, I would say late second trimester. Yes, that's what I would say, yeah.
Okay, so I looked into this briefly. The chapter opens with the explosion at the armory, the Royal Armory in Paris. And I just kind of Googled it, because a lot of times, like Diana has done and continues to do for the Revolutionary War period, she has that almanac that she can literally flip through, find a date, and place her characters, if at all possible, around a battle or around something that, you know, was actually part of history. I don't know about any kind of almanac for this time period in this place, but she usually doesn't, unless it's part of the actual storyline, like something the characters do, she doesn't usually necessarily make things up in the ambiance, if you will. She uses a lot of historical action and historical happenings. So I was just curious to see if this was actually something that happened. And I couldn't find anything, but I honestly didn't spend more than about 4 minutes.
Right. Yeah, no, and I had that same thought, actually, when I was rereading it in the last week. I'm sure it's real. I'm sure it's a real event. And maybe she found it in a, you know, it strikes me as something, she doesn't even bother with the date, right? So maybe the date isn't even really recorded. That's what she found, was that there was an explosion at the armory around the beginning of May.
Exactly.
And it just weaves, the reason so many of us love Diana's books is because it just weaves more texture into the story.
Exactly.
And sometimes you don't even, well, I probably didn't even see that on my first read, or maybe even my second read of the story. That was so long ago, I can't remember, though. But now, that's the kind of stuff we pick up on fifth and sixth reread.
Oh, absolutely. Summer reads to read, and she does pick things up. But because I'm taking notes, I read very closely. And I definitely have never read these books like this before. So it makes sense to me that that kind of thing wouldn't have popped out. But at the same time, yeah, it's very... If it truly didn't happen, it doesn't matter. It just adds to the, as you said, the weaving of the tapestry of the entire story.
Yeah.
But I have a feeling it's probably accurate.
My gut tells me that she mentioned that on purpose to try to set the date and the time and the reference point, and to add, because she always does those, you know, I want to add what three senses.
Mm-hmm.
And this is not one of those three senses, but it's just one of those things where you just add one little hint of historical accuracy to your fictional characters to make everything seem it could have actually happened.
Yeah, that's a very good point. Totally.
And of course, whether it happened or not, the most important thing was it got more patients to the L'Hôpital, which then made her and Mary stay later, which then enabled the whole thing to happen. So Claire is working at the L'Hôpital and is helping treat the victims of the explosion at the armory, which makes her workday even longer. She has sent Fergus home to tell Jamie that she'd be late, and Fergus had returned with Marta. We learn that Mary Hawkins is there at the hôpital as well. And it's finally time to go, and as they leave, they see Marta showing Fergus his knife-throwing skills. Now, LNG writes, lots of action in the beginning, and Claire and Mary staying late at L'Hôpital with Fergus and Murta awaiting them. And how do the men bide their time? With Highland dirk practice. And Ellen, I'm not going to lie, when I was copying over your comments, I thought it was something else.
You thought she said D-I-C-K
practice? I misread the R.
I mean, for real, I would not have put it past the Highlanders to do that as well, but I don't think that they would do that in the middle of the street.
No, not with another little boy.
No, no, no.
Marta is quite impressive, apparently. Fergus threw an onion at him.
Why is that? Incredibly funny following that conversation we just had.
Sorry. His knife throwing skills are quite impressive. Fergus threw an onion at him, and Marta deftly stabbed the onion. without barely moving. Mary was quite impressed and muttered to tell Fergus to get a coach, but there aren't any, he says. Fergus points to a dark alleyway and says, basically, let's go down there. It's a quick way through. That's the first thing.
That's like straight out of a horror
movie.
Yeah,
it is. I'll be right back. Separate. I'm just going to go alone into a dark alleyway.
Exactly. You never separate, and if anyone ever says, I'll be right back, they don't ever come back.
Don't go to dark alleys and don't go to basements.
Exactly.
As they passed a sailmaker's shop, they heard a cry of alarm from the watchman. Marta turns around to be on guard and pulls out his sword. Claire senses movement behind him in the doorway. Someone hits Marta, and then someone orders another to take care of Marta. Claire's arms are pulled from behind. So the first mention of the shop is a sailmaker's shop. So we hear about that there's a sailmaker's shop and then that there's a watchman. And then she realizes that the watchman isn't a watchman. He's bending over Marta's body and pulling this white fabric cover over him. Claire is hit in the side of the head. And Marta has been put in a sail bag. I wonder if the sailmaker, or the person who worked there or lived there, was in on this attack, or if his abode, was simply scavenged. You know, if he was attacked and they went to take his goods to use in this attack.
Right. Or could the imposter watchman have not the real watchman on the head and drag them into an alley. I don't know.
Absolutely. Any of the above.
But there must be sails hanging around this shop. Because
So the shop has to be legit. Otherwise, that's a big thing to, like, fake.
Yeah.
Although these people have skills and some kind of money, as we find out. So they're not the street urchins. The watchman was a fake. And he was wearing a mask. But Claire noticed he was wearing nothing other than a green shirt, a pair of breeches, and silk hose and leather shoes. So this guy was not a ne'er-do-well, or as I said, a street urchin. He was not one of the poor.
No.
They were also, some of the other guys, were also holding Mary. And one person was feeling under her skirts. The one holding Claire forced his tongue into her mouth. And here's another one of Diana's great descriptions. Quote, tasting strongly of drink and onions. And then Claire bit his tongue, and he hit her again, and she falls to her knees. That reminds me of ever since, and I've heard it, I think, twice, but it took me hearing it two or three times overall. I heard it from Diana twice and from others a few times. This is one of those examples where Diana has said, you make reference to three of the senses in order to put someone in a certain place, in a certain situation, in certain surroundings, and it makes the reader part of it.
Puts them there.
Yeah.
Makes it relevant.
So when I read this, tasting strongly of drink and onions, I was like, that's Diana. And also, lots of onions. I mean, all throughout that revolutionary period, dude, onions. When she kisses Jamie and they're making love, she tastes his onions. And I'm like, what? It's a lot of onions, so they must have been a good crop.
Well, yeah,
I like onions as much as anybody.
But actually, from a food storage point, onions are one of the few things that at that point you would have kept through the winter that would have been fresh,
right?
So they're full of vitamins, and they used to eat them raw like an apple.
Oh, wow.
So, yeah, I guess, I don't know, maybe you just don't taste it when everybody else is eating them, but oh, yeah. I'm not big on onion breath either, so I'm with you.
Oh. Yeah. Ellen G. writes, she also had the tenacity to bite the tongue of a man who tried to kiss her.
From a food preparer standpoint, or a chef standpoint, I think that when you cook the onions, they don't nearly have that kind of staying power as a raw onion does.
No, not at all.
I've had disagreements with people about this where they're like, no, I don't eat onions at all because I don't like having like onion breath for the rest of the night. And I was like, well, once you cook it, you know, even caramelize it, they don't have the same like pungency.
Well, not on your tongue. They're totally different. A lot of people have problems with onions and gas. So onions produce a lot of gas. In fact, there are, and I'm going to show a bit of ignorance here because I don't know what religion it is, but there is a religion in India that they don't consume garlic or onions because it prevents them from sitting still in meditation for long periods of time because it wreaks havoc on your digestive system, onions. So a lot of people, when they say they don't like onions, it's for more reasons than just taste.
Is that even true when you cook it? Because a lot of times,
yes,
certain things you cook, the breaking down of the enzymes in the cooking can then prevent some of the gas.
They totally change sometimes the body's reaction to it. But I just know personally a lot. But I know a lot of people that don't eat onions. I eat a lot of onions, but no raw onions. But yeah, my grandmother was one, and she's dead, so I can say that. But that's, I don't know. A lot of people don't like onions. As a chef, that's one of the number one things you hear, no onions.
Mm, wow. See, I'm different. I'd be like, no tomatoes. I don't like raw tomatoes.
Yeah, no, my husband doesn't like raw tomatoes either. He's convinced they make everything soggy.
They do?
But if you remove
the
seeds, then they don't. Anyway, this is a 20-year argument you don't want to get involved with.
Oh, well, I'm unfortunately on your husband's side with this. They ruin everything.
I would never pack a picnic with sandwiches full of tomatoes. But if I'm making a sandwich and I'm going to eat it right then and there,
yes,
then I'm going to have a nice thick slice of tomato on it. And so are you if you're having that sandwich. Whether you like it or not.
So Claire sees Mary's silver-buckled shoes kicking to get away, but she was being held and her skirt was pulled up. The man put his hand between her legs and yells out, "A virgin! I've got a virgin!" And I thought, and her name is Mary. That's awful. The reason I wanted to mention the silver buckled shoes is that they come back again and again in this chapter. And it's some kind of, if not symbol, just the movement or the action of what is happening when Claire sees those shoes. It's very telling and it's very kind of surreal at certain points, very active and then very surreal. So the man goes on with some stupid speech about how her husband will not encounter any awkward obstructions on his wedding night. Claire notes that it's not just the silk hose that pointed these men out as not your ordinary bandits. Rather, it's the manner of speech. Their manner of speech was also not one of an uneducated person, or at least a person with that hasn't been brought up around well-spoken people. The hands that grabbed her, she notices, were manicured, and a small beauty mark was above the area of one of the thumbs. Ellen G. shares, "Claire's state of mind during this event seems calm, taking all she can in so she can remember things she saw, in case they find the men who are doing this. Good breeches, buckled at the knee, silk hose, and leather shoes. And the way they spoke, not ordinary bandits, indeed. Who has a beauty mark on their hand? Who?"
Okay, that was almost like, who let the dogs out? I thought you were going to be like, who?
No.
No, my concern about that is like, is it like a genuine beauty mark? Because, I mean, I have a mole. I mean, it's a mole. I'm not going to call it a beauty mark. But I have a mole right around my clavicle. But people call it a beauty mark. And I was like, I don't think it's a beauty mark. It's a mole. So is it really a beauty mark? As in somebody painted it on there? Or does he just have a mole in his hand?
Yeah. Could he go eat it? I don't know. I've often wondered that.
Because wasn't this also the era of putting on little dots on your face?
Oh, for sure. And like heart-shaped crap. And like...
Yes, because, in a Breath of Snow and Ashes, I think, isn't it Philip Wiley loses his
the
beauty mark on to Claire's So, yeah, totally. I wouldn't think that anyone would paint a beauty mark. I don't know. Who knows? The French.
I mean, unless he was practicing for maybe planning to put one on his face later and he wanted to make sure he knew how to do it really well before he put it on his face, that would make sense to me.
Yeah.
But still, hands, dude.
So again, we get a sense of the station of the attackers. She notices the man who seemed in charge had on a pale shirt with darker spots. Maybe it was embroidery. They say, quote, "Your husbands and fiancés need never know."
The fact that one of them was clearly a virgin was that if she didn't have somebody significant other, in the future, they will be like, thank you. Obviously, they don't know who Claire is until the light hits her later. They don't know who Mary is. It's poorly lit. But they're making assumptions based on the fact that they're highborn ladies. And highborn ladies, generally of their age bracket, are married and are affianced. You're welcome. That was a really big word for me right now.
So they attempt to force Claire to perform oral pleasure upon one of them, although the plan, I think, is probably for all of them. And as they struggled, her hood fell back and her hair was freed, flying all around. She again notices little pieces of light in the street and Mary's silver shoe buckles catching the light and still kicking. She was now on her back, struggling with her would-be rapist. There was the sound of tearing cloth. As they struggled to gain control over Claire, and the one she'd begun to call Spotted Shirt was horrified and crossed himself. He says a prayer and says, La Dame Blanche, in terror. Spotted Shirt continued to back away and was making the sign of the horns against her. Ellen G. writes, what Diana did here by naming the attackers Spotted Shirt, etc. is very interesting. When her hood did fall back and she came out with her hair all over the place like a Medusa, La Dame Blanche. Jennifer F. writes, mythology has always interested me and the folk tales about white ladies are fascinating. Different variations can be found in so many different cultures. Female spirits of tragedy who are associated with men in some way, either by betrayal or loss. Very similar to banshees. In the French stories, they lure people to help them or obey them. If not, they would torment you. In Dragonfly and Amber, I think Diana Gabaldon was drawing more from Dutch folklore, where these white women were wise women, or what we would think of as witches, midwives, and herbalists. They are called Witteviven. In Celtic folklore, there is a fae called Liananshi, who lures men with love, sensuality, creativity, and inspiration, and then drives them mad. A unique musical group called the Medieval Babes has a Gaelic song called Lian and She. It's about a guy who has been driven mad by the Fae. He has become obsessed with her. He hears her calling to him. And these white women seem to be a mixture of different things. A siren, a banshee, witch, a haunting spirit, and a succubus all rolled into one.
And isn't that any man's dream? To have all of, like, to have a woman with all of those traits.
Well, last chapter it was Madonna and whore. You said yes.
I mean, all of those things go into the same. I mean, they're all in the same boat, in my opinion.
Jennifer shared with us a link to the song, the Lian and She song, and we will share that in our blog post as well.
La Dame Blanche is also a French opera. Did you know that?
Really? No. What year is it from?
It's, Well, I just pulled it up on Wikipedia so I could appear to be a bit more knowledgeable than I actually am.
Nicely done. I like how you work.
And it's actually written in 1825. But it's a comic opera. And the only reason I know anything about it is because I was in Paris a couple of summers ago, and I was on a walking tour, and I looked to my left, and there was a store called La Dame Blanche. And, of course, I took a picture. And, of course, I took about 10 pictures of it. And then I sent it to Diana on Twitter when I got home. And she said her response was a cryptic, what do you think? I make all this stuff up?
Oh, my goodness.
That sounds
so
like...
So if anybody's interested, you could look up La Dame Blanche. It has a Scottish little connection. There's definitely something going on there. She's definitely using the storyline from it a little bit as inspiration, at least.
Yeah, I love all these things because they're not necessarily tangents, little or not so little things like this crop up. I mean, people spend their professional academic careers, you know, on one tangent.
Exactly.
And it's amazing.
But, like, legit, that's one of the things I love about Diana is that everything, there's a lot of stuff going on in her head that she creates in this, like, fictional wonderland. But, you know, it's grounded in truth on several levels. Like, you know that there's historical accuracy involved, so you know that, you know, everything that she mentions, she got from somewhere on some regard. Like, there's nothing that she's just like, I'm going to pretend that all these men in kilts ran around with swords and, like, loved each other and did whatever. So I think...
And practiced with the
dirks. But I mean, that's something that you come to take for granted with her as an author, and it kind of spoils you for other authors as you read other books and things. You're just like, these people didn't spend any time doing nearly the amount of research she did, which is what can be appreciated. Because I can literally read her novels and know that I'm getting not only something that's going to be entertaining, but there's some historical accuracy, and I'm going to actually learn something.
We always learn things.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
Always learn things from her. So meanwhile, Mary's attacker has accomplished his goal. Mary is screaming. His friends, the attacker's friends, are trying to get him away from La Dame Blanche, but he was out of it since he was in the throes of pleasure. Where has Fergus been? We don't hear about Fergus at all once he points out the alley. And then, isn't that ironic? It's usually the person who says, there's an alley, or I'll be right back. He's the person who doesn't come back. And I guess Fergus actually didn't come back.
He did come back.
Until it was
but
too late.
When he came, no. But
it
when
was
he
too
came,
late for Mary.
It was, but when he came back with the right reinforcements.
So they hear feet approaching, and the two non-raping men leave.
How would you like to have that designation? I'm one of the non-raping men.
Not that they wouldn't have. They were about to, but... leaving the third to fend for himself, and then he takes off on his own. Someone comes shouting down the alleyway, yelling for the police. And who might that be? It's Alexander Randall. He surveys the scene and then brings down the lantern. That was interesting to me that I didn't see this kind of symbolism, so I really liked this. Ellen G. writes, and who comes to the rescue? Sort of. Alexander Randall. He brought down the light. Representing his spiritual side? Maybe so. Mary was sitting on her knees and shaking. One shoe lay on its side of the cobbles. Diana writes, silver buckle winking in the swaying light of the lantern. So her shoes are mentioned like 3 or 4 times, and these silver buckles, you're seeing the movement of the shoes when she's, you know, being attacked and trying to get away and kicking. And then the last time we hear about her shoe is... it's not on her anymore, this one shoe, and it does blink in the light, but it's now the light that Alexander has brought. Alice goes to Mary and asks her if she's all right. And Claire, being Claire, writes. Claire replies, of all the damn fool questions, naturally she isn't all right. She's just been raped. Sorry. Again, rape is not funny, but what a stupid question.
Let's take it a little more basic than that. When a man shows up in a situation like that, they don't know what to say. All they're trying to do is like, I don't know how to make this better. Are you okay? I mean, they're just, and that's all he can do. He can't fix anything. All he can do is try to ascertain.
He's not trying to fix it. He just wants to know what the heck has happened. Is she okay? Meaning like, is she alive and is she going to die? Right now, that's what I need to know. Because we need to take care of it in some way.
He's also a little bit of a bumbler. So, I mean, I kind of took a lot of those things into consideration when I read that.
And then, just like the light that Alexander brought down, a large figure drops in from above. It's Jamie. Of course it's Jamie. Fergus have gone to get him. The wee man is helped by Jamie to come down off of the roof. She notices that Mary is still shaking and, quote, oozing away from Alex's fumbling efforts to pat her.
Like 100% that word.
Are you patting me?
No, but
are
there's...
Are you okay?
No,
there are just raped. How can I help
Stop
you?
Stop it. She's patting me right now. Okay. There are so many, like, descriptive terms that Diana uses in this passage where she's like, she said she was like jelly and oozing, and I'm like, oh, this is awful. I'm like, I know that the whole experience she just went through was also awful, but the words she used to describe the aftermath were like uncomfortable.
Mm. Yes.
So she points out to Jamie where Marta is, and Jamie slits open the sack. Marta says, who hit me? And Jamie says, well,
I didn't.
Well, it wasn't me. Come along, man. We haven't got all night.
But I love that he, like, slits the sack and, like, Murtaugh comes, like...
is burst.
Right, exactly. He was, like, burst out of the sack. Like,
oh, my goodness.
I don't know. It was funny to me.
That's funny that he was, like, burst or reborn and Mary is no longer a virgin. That's very ironic.
Oh, my God.
There is all sorts of symbolism going on.
Well, there's something. Back at the ranch, Claire is not convinced that their plan is going to work. Mary is with them at Jared's, tucked in bed. Claire says that she needs a doctor, and Jamie says she has one, and it's you. There's a dinner party on tonight of all nights, and it's an important one. The Duke of Sandringham,
Monsieur Duvernay, Louise and Jules de la Tour, and others. Even the Comte Saint-Germain.
Which Claire was not expecting. But I feel bad for her because it's like he has to invite him or else it's weird. But that doesn't make the whole experience of him being there less weird.
The latter had been invited because Jamie did business with him. Well, Jared had, and then, of course, Jamie does. Jennifer F. writes, every time the Comte Saint-Germain is mentioned, I can't help but think of Rubinrot. Silly, I know, but I read a lot of YA novels, and the Precious Gem trilogy by Kirsten Gia is one of my favorites. I am currently learning German, and those books have been on the brain lately. It also gives Claire a chance to watch the man, the Comte, and she wears the crystal that Master Raymond had given her.
No, and Jamie had it put in like a gold
setting. Yes, so very fancy schmance.
He's like, we need to like display this because there's a reason for it. Everyone needs to know about it. And maybe that will keep people from trying to poison you as well as.
And Claire sums it up eloquently. What I wanted was peace, quiet, and total privacy in which to shake like a rabbit. What I had was a dinner party with a duke who might be a Jacobite or an English agent, a cult who might be a poisoner, and a rape victim hidden upstairs. Interesting, there's no mention of Alex, though. So her hands are shaking and Jamie has to help her put on a necklace. She asks him if he never has any nerves, and he says, oh, he does, but that they get him in the stomach. And then he asks for something for cramps. Oh, poor Jamie. Mary was in a spare bedroom on the second floor, and her injuries were limited to bruises and shock, and Claire had given her poppy syrup to keep her quiet.
Dude, that never ends well.
No.
Giving somebody an opiate, which is basically a hallucinogen, going into...
You either have to overdose them, not to kill them, but...
To put them out.
Put them out. Or be with them. And obviously, Alex did not do his job.
No, he was too soft. He's way too soft because he was... I think that the reason he was a bad caretaker is because he cared too much for her. So he definitely didn't want to, like, impede her, hurt her, or do anything that would...
He also caused trauma to her, given... And he wouldn't want to necessarily touch her. They may be infatuated with each other, but he is a cleric. And it is another... It's a different time. And he probably wouldn't have even wanted to, lay hands on her.
But she clearly needed somebody to restrain her.
Exactly.
Clearly. Exactly.
And here we learn about Alex Randall. He refused to go home, so he had been put to stand guard over Mary. And he was to get Claire if she woke up. We learned that Alex is in love with Mary, and he'd been following her around town. She is surprised, Claire, why he didn't speak up, and says that Mary would have run off with him in a moment. But of course, Jamie says that Randall is a gentleman, and Claire counters, you mean a silly ass. So, Jamie, of course, is right that he's a gentleman, and so much... would be lost if Mary's new station or lack thereof were discovered. She would be ruined. And if she were discovered, she would be ruined. If she ran off with Randall, she would be ruined. At least maybe not dishonored, but ruined and disowned and lose any touch or support of family, etc. But Jamie is convinced that no one will find her and that they'll be safe with Mary in that room. Uh-oh, is Mary in an upper room? I'm sorry.
Stop it.
Okay. The plan is to send Mary back to her uncle's in the morning, that she'd stayed the night with a friend. He reminds her that until she's able to speak and act as usual, she must stay hidden. If anyone finds out what's happened to her, she'll be ruined. Claire's aghast, but as I said, Jamie is right. In this time and place, it is how it is.
I often wonder whether or not they would have been better served to not drug her. Because if they'd, you know, gotten her into that headspace of, look, dude, we just need you to sit here and be quiet, and as soon as this is done, we're going to help you out. But the minute that drugs are introduced into it, she's
no
past
control.
Reason.
Yeah.
There's nothing she can do about it. She's
That's
in this weird
true.
Headspace. I wonder if they did themselves a disservice by drugging her.
Yeah,
but she was in...
I've never thought of that.
But she was in such shock... Well, she probably wasn't. She was either babbling or not making probably much. But I think all of it was done out of fear to what may happen if she got out. And also for their protection and hers. I think they did the best with what they knew and what they thought. Then Jamie realizes that Claire is likely still in a little shock. She is still shaking and tells him just how afraid she was. She wants him to make love to her right then, and she says, yes, it would help. But because of the dinner party and their guests and basically everything that's about to happen downstairs where they're expected,
downstairs,
that he would basically take a rain check. But they would get back to that. Jennifer F. writes, every time I read Dragonfly and Amber, I always get so anxious with this chapter. I want to just close my eyes and quickly get through all the bad parts, especially the part of the end during the dinner party. I just want to scream out, no, what are you doing? And so the dinner party begins. Apparently, not too much happened at first, because when we get into it, it's the second course already. They reach the second course without incident. Claire is busy faking conversation, all the while listening for movement upstairs. Now, she's probably not faking. She's paying enough attention so it's not fake, but she definitely is not concentrating completely on the dinner
now,
and the conversation.
And now, as far as food is concerned, I'm a little bit surprised that when we offered you to choose a chapter, you didn't pick one where we talked about, you know, the ones where they put baby birds in their mouths and ate them whole. So, I mean, they don't really reference the food as much as I would have thought.
What, in this chapter?
Yeah.
In the first paragraph, her hand is trembling over the consommé.
Oh, consommé.
Right? Mm. Which is probably one of the greatest things ever created by man.
Now, how would you describe a consommé?
A consommé is a clarified stock. So, and it's generally much richer than, so you make a beef stock, and there is actually a recipe for consommé on Outlander Kitchen. And, and then you clarify it, and you clarify it using more lean beef. And egg whites, because egg whites, when you put them into a hot liquid, they sort of attract all the impurities in the liquid and gather it up into the egg white. And then you just scoop the egg white and the beef out of there, and you've got a crystal clear soup that is even better than chicken soup for illness. It's just, it's got more beef in it, it's got more flavor in it, and it's just delicious. And you can eat it hot or cold.
Ew, does anybody eat that cold? I can't. I even, like, 100%, I don't like broths, but I would eat a broth when I'm sick. I would eat that hot, but the idea of drinking like, a cold beef broth and some sort of consommé kind of is a little nauseating.
It's different.
Maybe I'm just not sick enough.
It's different. It's not something I would have hot consommé if I was sick. Okay. But it's a summertime thing.
Now, do they, like, leach off, like, all of the fat off the top of it?
Yes.
So you're literally, you're, okay, because cold broth has, like, you know, congealed fat on top to me.
Yes. But okay. Until you scoop it off with your slotted spoon.
Right. So basically they're just drinking, like, a savory liquid.
Yeah, and it's quite often used to open the appetite up, right? So to get the taste buds flowing and the saliva flowing. So all these things at the beginning of a French meal are generally to do that. So, and they're very small. I don't know what the first course was. We're not entirely sure. But the second course is consommé, and that's really, really light, right? That's why they eat eight courses, because they're not all French fries and hamburgers.
No, I don't imagine they would be.
I was just on a cruise, and I watched people have a first course of a hamburger, a second course of a hamburger, and a third course of a hamburger. So,
oh, my gosh. I mean, I did a cruise once, and the thing that you learn on the cruise is that they serve you a plate, and you order what you want ahead of time and or when the waiter comes around. But what you find out is if you do one of those tours and you talk to the people, they're like, you can order as many of these meals as you would like.
Yes.
But you have to, but you do have to do it at the beginning. So on lobster night, you can order 3 or 4 lobster meals. You just literally have to order them when the server comes around.
Yes.
In the quantity that you want them, which I found completely nauseating, FYI. But
yes, it is. I've sat at a cruise. I've only been on 2 cruises, but the first cruise we went on, I sat at a table, and the woman insisted that she wanted all 3 lobster tails on the table at once. It was...
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, it was... yeah, it's... we ate a lot in the room.
Oh my god. I don't blame
you. We had a balcony and they did room service and it was lovely. I'm not big on buffets to begin with, but the dining room was lovely.
Oh wow, I didn't even know. I mean, I guess it makes sense depending on your room size or whatever, how, whether or not you could have food back in your room.
Okay. Yeah, anybody can have food in the room. You just wouldn't want to eat it in an inside cabin, I don't think. It's rather depressing in an inside cabin, but...
No, most cabins are literally large enough for like maybe a 2x4 square of walking space in between some bunk beds. That's most cabins. They have roomier ones. Those are way more expensive than I've ever been able to afford on a cruise. But I'm usually in like that teeny tiny space where literally the only time you ever spend in your cabin is when you need to sleep.
Oh.
No, you got to get the last minute deal, man, on the balcony.
Apparently. Yeah. I'm going to have to book that. You're gonna send me some tips.
I will.
Okay, thank you. thank you.
Claire makes a point of stroking the crystal at her neck, and the Comte doesn't even notice or react. So the Comte is not the dude.
I wouldn't say that he's not the dude. I think he's just smarter. He's definitely smarter, and we'll find that out later.
That is true. In later chapters. Yeah, but it was made a point twice. Jamie said that he was one who couldn't really hold in his emotion. He talks about what he talks about, or you see his emotion on his face. Somewhat, I guess, like Claire. And then that was from Jamie telling her. And then when he was in their conversation, when he was speaking, you could see it that it was true as he spoke. You could see his emotion writing on his face. So his mind and his attention was elsewhere. It wasn't on Claire and her stroking her crystal. But I think there were few enough people there that, you know, there weren't hundreds of people where he wasn't going to be able to see Claire. I think that this is enough. And I know we find out more later, but I think this dinner party was enough for us to not take him off the list as being a dangerous person, but take him off the list of who would have poisoned her in the instance before.
I mean, he doesn't appear to be actively pursuing anything on that regard.
When they mention the Patagonia, he never looks at Claire.
But that could have been 100% a choice. Because if I'm in a group of people and I know that I've done something bad, I'm not going to look at the person that I did wrong when somebody brings it up.
I get it, but he also can't keep his emotion down because you see that clearly on his face. That's actually when I think it was
flushes.
That conversation.
He definitely flushes.
But he gets angry, or I mean, he doesn't like explode, but he does talk about, you know, how he got the loan with His Royal Highness.
Yes, he can't resist that.
Oh my gosh, yeah, exactly. So all guests were in conversation, and Jamie thought he'd make acquaintance with the Duke and see if it would help find out the identity of the sender of the musical message to Charles Stuart. But Claire could only watch Silas Hawkins. He had been an unexpected guest, and just their luck. They were still going through the courses, and Claire was trying to calculate how much time was left before they'd all be gone. Then the conversation went to street gangs, and this is a little bit too
convenient.
You know,
I don't know how many conversations I've had that have segued into street gangs. But it's been way too many for me to be comfortable with.
I thought that was quite a coincidence, and General d'Abonville said, quote, "I have heard that some of those roving bands are composed not of rabble, but of some of the younger members of the nobility." Jamie excuses himself to get some special port for the Duke. The men are talking about Jamie's fine wine, and the Comte says soon they'll be having an even finer wine. And Silas Hawkins brings up the unfortunate events of the Patagonia, and the Comte's reaction was to turn bright red. This is when Claire sees what Jamie had meant. You could read his feelings on his face. He didn't have a lot of self-control over
he has no
emotion.
Game. I think that's the end of it. You see, he literally has no game. And I don't blame him. I mean, some people just have, like Claire, glass faces.
So, Teresa, if I or we have missed any important food moment or food mention, please interrupt us.
Well, we're right there. We're right at Cheese Savory. When Silas Hawkins, he's kind of I always have this really funny picture of Silas Hawkins sitting there popping down all these cheese savories while basically just being a shit.
What exactly is a cheese savory?
A cheese savory is a course. So it can be a number of things. I chose to make it a gougère, which is like a cream puff, but a savory one. So it's made from the same dough. as a cream puff or an eclair. And it's made from the same dough. So instead of sweet, you put cheese in it and you bake it. And it's like this puff, like a little puff ball full of cheese that you can literally pop one after the other into your mouth. And they're really popular at wine tastings in France.
Oh, nice. Yeah, I was literally at Sam's Club yesterday and I found this like tray of like, it was like fresh mozzarella sticks that were wrapped in like three different kinds of cheeses. One was like pepperoni and one was cheese prosciutto. Meat.
I was like, I would have it except that that's not prosciutto.
No. It was fresh mozzarella wrapped in meat and one was pepperoni, one was prosciutto, and one was like something that started with an S, like sabrososa? I don't even
know.
Thank you. And I was like, those look way too good because, you know, I don't eat a lot of carbs. And I was like, this sounds perfect for me for a snack. And I bought them. And so, like, for me, for a cheese course, that would be my cheese course. I've had, like, one of, like, each, and they were each delicious. They're probably going to last me about a month because it was from Sam's Club, but delicious.
So those are the cheese savories. Are those the same things that the Duke is shoveling onto his plate?
Yes, they're all
in that course. That was a popular dish here then. Oh, my goodness.
Yeah,
cheese is always popular.
Melty, cheesy things are always popular.
Thank you. Everyone loves cheese. It turns out another Scot had agreed to help him finance the shipment of his new wine. Now, him being the Comte Saint-Germain. Charles Stuart. The reaction was, Silas Hawkins sat bolt upright, Jamie sat down and didn't utter a word, and Jules, quote, began to spray exclamations and globules of spit. And the d'Arbonville were amazed. The Duke was interested as well. The Duke says he thought the Stuarts were poor. We learn about the state of Jacobite affairs. They are known to be poor. The supporters have been seeking funds, but thus far haven't had luck. Charles Stuart had spoken with bankers. The Comte continues that the prince had secured a loan of 15,000 livres from an Italian bank and placed the entire sum at his disposal to get a ship and purchase the bottling. And he has a signed letter, because earlier he had said he has a finer wine coming out.
Yes.
Or he will have one.
He thinks he does.
Then Louise begins to turn the topic of conversation to Claire's crystal that she's wearing. Just as she's about to say where she got it, there's a scream that stops all conversation.
Did you say scream or stream?
Scream.
Okay, scream. Yes, that scream would have stopped all conversation.
All the guests went into the foyer, and Mary Hawkins is at the top of the stairs in only her shredded shift, her hands across her bosom, and they could all see.
I guess they never noticed that she showed up in a shredded shift. Shredded shift. They couldn't have given her anything else to wear?
I don't know if she shredded it herself.
I'm just saying.
It's a bit odd they didn't put her to bed in a new...
Thank you!
Yeah, it's a bit odd. I've never noticed that either.
They couldn't have put her to bed in something that, had she, in a drug-induced state, decided to come downstairs, would have
because
been a little bit...
Because that's what he ripped, right?
Would have been a little bit more, like, less... What, more or less?
Well, you would think, though, that it would also have... probably some blood on it, maybe, and maybe...
Thank you! I mean, they didn't change her out of her clothes?
Yeah, it's kind of like, you know what it reminds me of? If you watch Sons of Anarchy, whenever somebody gets beat up, they always spend the rest of the episode in their bloody shirt, and I'm always like, why aren't they changing? It doesn't make any sense. Like, oh, hi, police officer, don't mind all this blood all over my shirt.
No.
And it seems a bit odd that you wouldn't put a woman in great distress into a new nightgown and put her to bed. But
no,
anyway,
and for reference, maybe they didn't like 100%, for 100%, if I'm, like, doing anything in the kitchen and I spill something on myself, I'm going to go change my clothes. Stuff, but that doesn't make any sense to me.
You need an apron, girl.
I do have an apron. I'm just a really messy chef. And by chef, I mean cook. As in home. Home cook.
So as Mary is standing there in her shredded shift, hands across her bosom, they could all see her bruises. She is yelling to her assailants to let her go. So she's obviously, as Summer said, she was far enough gone with the poppy syrup to be resting, quote unquote,
she
but it
so
went over into delirium.
Like, she's so drugged out right now. That's all I see. And when Claire says she's not seeing anything.
Yeah.
Like her, which says to me that she's just like, her eyes are vacant. She is present someplace well, I think elsewhere. Her,
I think they were contracted, right? Her pupils had contracted. They were very small.
Yes.
I don't.
So she wasn't getting a lot of
light. What I remember, forget the light. What I remember was clearly her saying she wasn't seeing anything. I'm just saying she was hallucinating.
She's an awful lot like Jamie is at the Abbey.
Yeah.
Right. You would
only
be
with
totally
less lavender.
Yeah, less,
and like
and less water and less water flopping around or whatever it was. But
yes, that.
I don't know. I've had one. I took one opiate in my life as a painkiller and then went to sleep, and it was the worst, most panic-filled dream I've ever had in my whole life, and I took the pills back the next day. They're not for everybody, they're not for me. But when you said earlier that it was like maybe a bad plan to give her the opiates, I was like, yeah.
Alex Randall, who was trying to stop her from hurting herself, ended up being clawed at by Mary, who only saw his shape and in her non-lucid state assumed he was another attacker.
Naturally.
Claire admits from below, it looks like he was acting as a reduced...
No, not a reduced anything.
Reduced? Claire admits from below, it does look like he was acting as a rejected seducer. And that's what people, of course, were assuming. And as you say, she doesn't describe it, but in a woman who looks kind of crazy, who has a torn shrift, who has a torn shift, likely, as you say, with blood on it, and a guy coming after her trying to stop her from getting away, it looks like. Yeah, it's just, it all looks bad. And pandemonium ensues.
Naturally. Like, literally naturally.
Pandemonium ensues. Silas Hawkins is making his way up to Mary, and Jamie does some kind of circus acrobat trick magic and leaps onto the stairway in front of any of the guests before they can reach Mary.
No, but what's so funny is he literally looks at Claire like, WTF am I supposed to do right now? And then he's like, okay, I can't circumvent anything that's happened from here to there. The only thing I can do as a host
above it
is go and, like, knock Alex Randall out, because that's the only thing I, as a host and the people in my house, the only thing I can do to, like, try to circumvent it and be part of the solution as opposed to the problem, which is this crazy lady, like, having a hallucinatory experience on my staircase.
Diana writes, quote, "It was such an acrobatic feat that one or two ladies gasped. Little cries of admiration intermingled with their exclamations of horror." Then he gets between Mary and Alex and punches the latter in the jaw.
What?
And Alex collapses. And we have end scene.
End scene.
This was, not just did stuff happen, but this was it's not the most dramatic chapter in the book, but it's a very dramatic chapter in the book. This, I think, is the definitive chapter, or the events in this chapter are the definitive events that allow certain timelines to continue as they do to make the story what it is. So LNG writes, "The cast of characters, invited and not, at the dinner, I don't know how Claire did keep it together. All of the information they get from this dinner is good, especially that Saint-Germain is working with Charles to get some good red." And the end to end all ends of this chapter is pretty funny in a slapstick way, balancing out the horror of the rape at the beginning of the chapter. And I think that's a good observation.
It is a really good observation, yeah. It sure came home for me this time when I was reading it, that there's a sort of pandemonium at the beginning, at the time of the rape, and then there's pandemonium at the end, and it sandwiches whatever's in the middle. It's really rather clever, and it takes what was a pretty nasty beginning and pretty rapey to a funny conclusion. Right?
So rapey. Even based on the title of the chapter, so rapey.
And in the middle, it's like a pandemonium sandwich, right? And in the middle is what? In the middle is Claire, or are Claire and Jamie in that one little scene upstairs. That's the only, even though she's still a little shaky, that's the only thing next to calm that we have.
That's totally true, yeah.
So yeah, that was not the funnest chapter.
No.
As far as, you know, the rape.
Oh my God.
The end always makes me laugh, though. Diana does pandemonium so well, and she usually includes at least one scene like that in each book where there's just people everywhere, and people are screaming, and it's being like in the middle of a crowd, in the middle of a riot, kind of. And it's rather funny. Yeah. It's rather funny to read about. It's not very much fun to be in the middle of.
I definitely would not want to be in the middle of that.
No. So my question here is, do you have a recipe for consommé?
I do, on OutlanderKitchen.com. It's already there.
Okay, let's find it.
She has consommé and she has the cheese.
And then I also have
savory.
Yes, gougères.
We will link to all of it.
Please do. So, and I actually have, it doesn't reference this chapter, but I do have a cocktail named after the Count Saint-Germain, and it uses Saint-Germain elderflower liqueur, and it's really tasty. It's more a summertime drink, but it's still fun.
Because, like, my instinct was, like, because he's a dick, I'm like, this is...
Well, yeah.
I'm not even talking.
If you go to the recipe on Outlander Kitchen, it's actually a funny photo. I've put it in the middle of a pentacle of salt.
Yeah.
Because it's from a different chapter. It's from a chapter that's later on in the book, and it does make sense when you read the excerpt and everything. But I've had a few, especially people whose English is a second language, who are quite concerned for my spiritual well-being based on that pentacle of salt. Yes, yes, yes. I attract a certain number of trolls. I don't know what it is about me, but I attract them.
It's just the nature of
it. Well, and I appreciate their concern for my soul.
Absolutely.
Yes, I mean, you know?
I was a little concerned for your soul with all the carbs you keep cooking, but I let it go, and I looked for alternatives.
Yeah. I don't know. I just walk every day, so I do eat carbs, but I don't eat as many as people think I do, I don't think, but... I give a lot of food away. A lot of the food on the blog that you see is given to neighbors.
I want to move next door to
we
you.
We even have a you know, we have a like a marketplace on a Facebook page for Pender Island, and I've been known to post pictures of, you know, like a sweet potato pie. I think sweet potato pie went up on the Pender Island online market, and it was gone in 5 minutes. I don't sell them. I just give them away so that we don't eat them all, because if we did, we wouldn't be very healthy people. So.
No, but I literally want to live next door to you because you're apparently giving away amazing food to your neighbors.
And I get eggs in return. It's actually a very good bartering.
That's amazing.
That makes sense.
Yes, it works very well.
So that was chapter 18, entitled Rape in Paris. Please join us next week when we discuss chapter 19, which is entitled An Oath is Sworn. And again, I'm super grateful to Miss Gavaldone for giving me chapters I can pronounce without assistance.
Yes, I've had a rough few weeks there.
Oh my God, L'Hôpital? L'Hôpital des Anges? That was nightmares. That was nightmare-inducing for me.
But now you can say it in your sleep, I bet.
I can now, but like the build-up to that was like horrific.
So, as always, we look forward to our next episode. Thank you, everyone who has listened. And thank you very much, of course, to our guest, Teresa from Outlander Kitchen. And we hope that you will be back and maybe to talk about that cocktail.
Hey, yeah.
And with another chapter. And definitely when you have more information about anything that may be coming our way from Outlander Kitchen.
I will make sure you know first. Thank you so much for having me today. You guys are always a lot of fun.
No, thanks for coming. We have a great time.
Thank you so much.
Visit our website at www.outlanderpod.com. Follow us on Twitter at @outlanderpod. Find us on Facebook at facebook.com/outlanderpod, or email us at outlanderpod@gmail.com. I dreamt it last night.